This is Free Speech Radio News for Tuesday, March 12, 2002. I'm Nell Abram. Israel launches its largest ground offensive in two decades. Hundreds of Palestinians are taken into custody. Electoral observers in Zimbabwe call the elections there neither free nor fair, and union members are picketing at the gates of Lockheed Martin, the nation's largest defense contractor. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Randy Zimmerman with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Tonight, the state of Georgia will execute a British citizen despite that country's request for life without parole. Anastasia Kershaw reports from London.
43-year-old Tracy Hustall will become the first British citizen to be executed in America for 7 years when he dies tonight in Jackson State Prison, Georgia. Hustall, who's convicted of the 1985 killings of a hitchhiker and has allegedly admitted to 17 other murders, saw the failure of a last-ditch clemency plea yesterday, despite efforts of the European Union and the British government, which opposed the death penalty. Also lobbying was the original trial lawyer who admitted making a string of errors. Hustall's lawyers have argued for a lesser sentence because the jury which condemned him to death did not know of extenuating factors like low blood sugar levels, which made him prone to psychotic episodes. This is Anastasia Kershaw reporting from London for Free Speech Radio News.
Legislators from the United States and Mexico are calling on their governments to form a bi-national commission to investigate the murder of hundreds of women in Ciudad Juarez. Kent Patterson has more.
Speaking at a recent rally in downtown El Paso, Texas State Senator Elliot Shapley urged the crowd to seek justice for the more than 300 women murdered in Juarez since 1993.
If we do not send a message to those who are committing the most heinous of murders in Juarez, where torture and rape, where people's faces are carved off with acid in Juarez today, then who are we in our community to sit silent while this is going on?
Senator Shapley joins a growing list of politicians from Mexico and the United States who are joining a campaign launched by women's and labor groups. They demand the governments of Mexico and the United States establish a binational commission to investigate previous sex-related killings and prevent new ones from occurring. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Kent Patterson reporting.
The Bush administration proposes U.S. families in need have their child care funding frozen and mandatory work hours increased. Rhett Buckley reports from the Capitol.
Secretary of Health and Human Services Tommy Thompson defended this proposal at the Senate Finance Committee. Regarding child care, Secretary Thompson defended parental choice and suggested that parents consider options such as a neighbor, a family member, or a faith-based organization. However, Chairman Max Baucus openly disagreed with the tactics of President Bush.
No parent should have to spend their workday or work night worrying that their child may not be in good hands. The administration's proposal to increase weekly participation requirements by 33% without any new child care funding causes me to be concerned.
Though Secretary Thompson came under fire for his stance on child care, both Democrats and Republicans applauded him for endorsing the reauthorization of the Temporary Assistance for Needy Families, or TANF program, as well as encouraging bipartisan efforts to improve the current welfare policy. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Rhett Buckley.
Federal government officials are looking to open the way for developers by seeking a temporary end to habitat protection for salmon in four western states. Andrew Geller reports from Portland.
In a proposed settlement entered in federal court yesterday, the National Marine Fisheries Service said it would eliminate and then revise the protections to settle lawsuits filed by the Association of California Water Agencies, the National Association of Home Builders, and 16 other groups of developers and local governments. The developers and local governments filed suit, contending the protections were excessive, unduly vague, not justified as essential, and not based upon a required analysis of economic impacts. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Andrew Geller in Portland, Oregon.
And finally, Native American students at the University of Northern Colorado have taken the Indian mascot debate to a new level. Nell Geiser has more.
An intramural basketball team at UNC in Greeley has dubbed themselves the Fightin' Whiteys. Members of the multiracial team wanted to protest an Eaton High School mascot. The school's sports teams are called the Reds and are represented by an Indian with a large nose wearing a loincloth and a feather. The superintendent of Eaton School District has not been responsive to criticism, saying that the mascot is not meant to be a mockery of Native Americans. But in the ongoing debate over Indian mascots, proponents of the Fightin' Whiteys say the unusual choice of mascot is a good way to help people understand what it's like to be made fun of. Ray White, a member of the Mohawk Nation and part of the basketball team, says the team name and its mascot of a middle-aged white man is not meant to be vicious, it's meant to be humorous. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Nell Geiser in Boulder, Colorado.
And I'm Randy Zimmerman for Free Speech Radio News.
The Israeli army sent thousands of troops backed by tanks and helicopter gunships into Palestinian areas of the West Bank and Gaza Strip today in a massive operation to round up militants. 30 Palestinians are reportedly dead and hundreds taken into custody in Israel's biggest ground offensive in 20 years. Palestinian gunmen killed 7 Israelis. The Israeli army said its aim is to arrest militants and dismantle what it calls the infrastructure of terror. Palestinian officials accuse Israel of starting to reoccupy the West Bank and Gaza Strip so that no progress can come from U.S. Envoy Anthony Zinni's mission to the region beginning on Thursday. Raphael Kraft has the story from Tel Aviv.
While Ariel Sharon announced yesterday he was ready to let Yasser Arafat move freely, the Israeli army invaded most of Ramallah last night, where the Palestinian president is imprisoned since December. It is Israeli army's biggest operation against Palestinians since the start of the Intifada. Along with troops, F-16 fighters and Apache helicopters, 150 tanks moved into the city, killing 5 Palestinians. Abu Leila, the head of the Democratic Front for the Liberation of Palestine, describes the situation on the ground.
Israelis entered the city of Ramallah and Bira from all different axes, and they are concentrating actually on the refugee camps in Amari and Qaddura. And actually the both cities are in their hands now, with the exception of a small circle which is less than a kilometer in diameter.
What about Mr. Arafat?
Mr. Arafat is still in his compound. I saw him this morning. He is in very good shape and his morale is very high. He is still in his compound. The Israeli tanks are about 100 meters away from the compound, and they have during the night occupied some of the buildings that control the compound. So they from time to time sporadically shoot at the compound.
In the Gaza Strip, 23 people have been killed in a fierce Israeli incursion in the Jabalia refugee camp. José Vericat, correspondent for Spanish newspaper El Mundo, is in Jabalia.
In the morning, after the incursion, as people came out of their houses and realized the enormity of the disaster of what had happened the night before, people were really in a state of shock. Wherever you went, the roads, the streets of Jabalia were almost blocked by all the different tents set up by the families of the dead. But before really even recovering from this shock, people were already, the microphones and loudspeakers were already calling for revenge.
Do people expect anything from Mr. Zinni's visit next Thursday?
Absolutely nothing. I think there is a complete disjunction between the movement on the diplomatic level and the facts on the ground. I think we're in a circle of violence, and people feel this is a personal challenge between them and Sharon because of the history that he has with the Palestinians, and it's a question of who is going to give up first. I think that the Palestinians at the moment they feel, often has been said, that this is their war of liberation.
The Israeli offensive on refugee camps is not likely to stop before the arrival of U.S. retired General Anthony Zinni next Thursday. as Israelis are willing to finish the job they started on February 28th that consists in arresting and killing what they call terrorists. According to observers, it is also a way for the Israeli government to weaken the Palestinian Authority on the negotiation table. Abu Leila.
The mood here, even amongst the PNA personal leadership, is very adamant that there will be no concessions, no political concessions or security concessions, whatever happens, and if the Israelis want to continue, let them continue.
On the Israel-Lebanese border, 7 Israelis were killed this afternoon in a bus attack by unknown gunmen. In this atmosphere of steadfastness on both sides, the diplomatic reactions regarding the violence of Israel's incursions is very shy, as was Kofi Annan's. This afternoon in New York, the United Nations General Secretary carefully blamed both sides despite the amount of Palestinian victims.
I am profoundly disturbed by the increasing use of heavy weaponry by Israel in civilian areas. Large-scale military operations have taken place throughout civilian areas and refugee camps in the West Bank and Gaza, causing large-scale loss of life. In addition, the International Committee of Red Cross and other agencies are reporting growing disregard on the part of the Israeli Defense Forces for the safety of medical and ambulance personnel. On the other side, the Palestinians have played their full part in the escalating cycle of violence, counter-violence and revenge.
While the bloodshed and mass arrests continue with full impunity in the occupied territories, 50,000 Israeli settlers and ultra-religious demonstrated yesterday in Tel Aviv's Rabin Square, asking Sharon for tougher measures against Palestinians. Many banners were asking for the transfer of Palestinians from the West Bank and Gaza to other Arab countries, a measure shared by 46% of the Israeli Jewish citizens. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Raphael Kraft in Tel Aviv.
A senior opposition figure was charged with treason today as counting began in Zimbabwe's election, a bitter contest in which critics accused President Robert Mugabe of violence and cheating to stay in power. Opposition Movement for Democratic Change leader Morgan Tsvangirai, who unsuccessfully appealed to the High Court to extend the poll into a fourth day, said many of his followers were deliberately prevented from voting. Across the country, MDC vote counters and election observers have been beaten and fled the counting rooms. Free Speech Radio News correspondent Zoe Eisenstein spoke to one of them, Prasad Mungulube, in rural Zimbabwe.
Prasad Mungulube is a polling agent for the Opposition Movement for Democratic Change. That means he's supposed to monitor these elections, which have been marred by allegations of irregularities and violence. 31-year-old Mungulube was supposed to arrive at the local counting centre at 6 o'clock this morning to supervise the counting of ballot papers after the three-day poll. But when I met him at the Bankit police station, he was crouching down in pain, his eyes bloodshot, with bloodstains splashed across his shirt, and scared for his life. He wanted the police to protect him after a group of around 15 ZANU-PF militia, led by Ignatius Chombo, who's a local MP and government minister, attacked him on his way to the counting centre.
And then they started beating me, forcing me, some were holding my legs and some were holding all my hands, trying to push into their truck. It took almost about 25 to 30 minutes whilst I was resisting to go into their truck. That is the time they keep on beating me with their booted boots, clenched fists. Some of them, they were just kicking me with on the chest, whilst I was trying to escape from the scene. Later on, the time that most of the people, they come from the location, they were watching the situation. Most of them, they were afraid to help me or to rescue me due to the fact they were afraid of the ZANU-PF militia.
Police officers also stood and watched while the militia beat Mungulube, but they did nothing. Mungulube says the local militia received some of their instructions from the police.
They were there, the police. So they did not help me. Later, after those people have been escaped, that is when the policeman started asking me, what happened? And then I told him that you were there, but you were not supposed to be asking me. You were there. You are not supposed to ask whilst we were seeing what was happening. Then he started to convince me, no, we are not shouting. But now I didn't comply with his instruction because it seems as though he was behind the scene as well.
Ungulube's sister heard he was being beaten and rushed to the scene with three other police officers. They brought Ungulube to Bankit police station, but officers, including one who beat Ungulube last month, were unwilling to help.
No, they didn't manage to help me because they were just looking at me. I even asked them for help so that I can give some police officers to the hospital, but nobody have managed to help me.
Ungulube believes that we arrived just in time. He says that without our presence, the militia would have come to get him, to kill him. We gave Ungulube a ride back to the capital, Harare, where he has an uncertain future.
Now, the situation at the moment in Harare, I don't have where to go at the moment. So it seems as though the situation is very difficult at the moment. I'm going to consult from the MDC office so that sometimes they may help me.
But he is convinced Morgan Tsvangirai, the opposition leader, will be the genuine winner of these elections.
Yeah, the election is supposed to be won by President Tsvangirai of MDC. But due to the fact some of the polling agents, they were chased from their polling stations, and most of them, they were abducted, and they left the polling station without somebody who was looking for those people. I understand that there is a possibility of rigging in this election.
Journalists are not allowed in to witness the vote counting. The only source of news is state television and radio. Final results of the election are expected sometime tomorrow, but it's uncertain what will happen if Mugabe declares victory. For FSRN, I'm Zoe Eisenstein in Harare, Zimbabwe.
Last weekend in Bolivia, during an historic 15,000-person gathering in La Paz, the principal leader of the Cocalero, the coca growers movement, was named the socialist presidential candidate for this summer's elections. Tim Russo reports from Cochabamba.
The nomination of Evo Morales and the tremendous show of support that he maintained from the most marginalized sectors of Bolivian society coincided with the director of the Drug Enforcement Agency, Asa Hutchinson's, visit to Santa Cruz, Bolivia, to participate in the World Conference Against Narco-Trafficking. The nomination of the 42-year-old Aymara Indian, Evo Morales, who was recently expelled from Congress illegally, represents a definitive obstacle to the United States' anti-narcotics, zero reduction and eradication policy for Bolivia, which has been dubbed Plan Dignity. Evo Morales has been the focus of much attention in Bolivia since the late January Cocalero uprising that rejected the implementation of two anti-coca laws. The Cocaleros were brutally repressed by the military, resulting in a death toll of approximately 30 people and hundreds of injuries after 3 weeks of intense street battles that ended with a government suspension of the laws that had provoked the initial reaction. George Ann Potter, board member of the Drug Policy Foundation, explains recent events surrounding Evo Morales and the harsh repression suffered by the Cocaleros during the January-February social explosion in Cochabamba.
In late November, President Quiroga passed two laws that closed the last legal markets for coca in the Chapare. It wasn't until January that the Cocaleros first marched peacefully here in the city, 5,000 strong, with the support of many other sectors, and then the next day tried to negotiate with the government about not closing the last legal market, and instead it turned to conflict. In the next 3 days were very violent, both here in the city and in Sacaba. And in those 3 days, 7 people were killed, 3 peasants and 4 armed forces. Evo Morales was kicked out of Congress because families of the murdered uniform, but nobody cared about the murdered peasants, brought a suit against Evo to kick him out of Congress, illegally, unconstitutionally.
Hutchinson's and other U.S. officials' recent criticisms that current Bolivian President Quiroga Tuto has been soft on eradication were met with a backlash of official responses from Quiroga's administration, referring to the lack of U.S. sensitivity in understanding the Bolivian reality. Oscar Oliveira, the internationally recognized leader for the coordination against the privatization of water based in Cochabamba, described the expulsion of Evo Morales from Congress as a blow to the U.S. government. In this last conflict during January, February, we saw that there is a profound connection between the cocaleros and the people from the city. This made it possible that Evo Morales' expulsion be considered by the people an expulsion of all social movements from parliament. That would have signified the destruction of all the social movements if they had destroyed the strongest movement, the cocaleros. But the people realized this and said that we can't allow this to end in defeat. It has to end with victory. And it ended with a definitive victory. The legislation and the other measures taken against coca not only ended in absolute defeat for the government, but also ended in defeat for the North American embassy, since they are ultimately the ones that determine the policy towards coca here. Wilde Moscoso, a regional leader of the Cocalero movement from the most conflictive zone in Chapare, explained the importance of Evo Morales' recent nomination.
This meeting has been a very successful meeting, maybe even more so than we had hoped, because there were compañeros from all of the different departments in Bolivia that came and we elected our candidate for MAS, and it is Evo Morales. So he's going to be our leader, and through him we're going to work together to get out of this misery and constant humiliation that we live in here. All of the impoverished are discriminated, and for those of us in Bolivia, the worst is that he who speaks the truth is jailed, tortured, and incarcerated. That is why we have been obliged to take on a political party like the union organizations to have our rights respected.
For Free Speech Radio News, this is Tim Russo reporting from Cochabamba, Bolivia.
International Women's Day was celebrated last weekend in Chiapas. Luz Ruiz reports from Mexico.
With the beginning statement that International Women's Day is a day of struggle and protest, International Women's Day kicked off in San Cristóbal de las Casas, Chiapas. Women, men, and children from indigenous and non-indigenous communities gathered March 8th in front of the Attorney General's office to take part in the reading of a series of claims and demands that address the violation of women's human rights, the effects of globalization, corruption, impunity, and sexism within the Mexican justice system, and the growing violence against women in a variety of shapes. Rosalinda Sanchez, a 24-year-old Tzotzil indigenous woman who works in the weaving cooperative Jolón Mayatik and who for several years has participated in the town's International Women's Day activities, explains the many shapes that violence can have and the importance of talking about it on this day.
Para nosotros como mujeres,
for us, indigenous and non-indigenous women, it's important that we participate, that we unite to women's struggles because we know that we face violence in the home, on the streets, everywhere. And that's why today is a special day for women all over the world. For example, there are women who come here to the towns from the communities and they are underpaid and they have to work a lot in their homes too. And that is a form of violence that we face a lot. And today, even though we may go to the streets and march, they don't listen to us. But what we want is for women to be heard by their partners and other women that up till today have not participated in the mobilizations and the rallies.
Natalia Arias, longtime activist and feminist, read the Women's Collective Statement in front of the Attorney General's office. The end of militarization and paramilitarization in the state, the implementation of the San Andres Accords, and the resolution to human rights attorney Digna Ochoa and the women in Juarez murders were only some of the many demands presented through Arias' voice. She further elaborated on the particular impacts on women created by neoliberal economic policies.
In Mexico, in Chiapas,
In Mexico, in Chiapas, we are protesting against this neoliberal regime imposed by the United States in benefit of corporations. It has violently impacted all spheres of our lives and those of our families. Privatization of land here in Chiapas concentrates ownership in a few foreign and elite hands that turns us into slaves for their companies and leaves us with no other option than to migrate to the United States because we cannot produce our basic food. We women invite you on this March 8th to join together and work collectively against the neoliberal economic policies, national and international, that impoverish us, loot us, exploit us, oppress us, and discriminate against us.
Alejandro Mosqueda, a member of the men's collective Puerta Negra, the Black Door, a support and study group that focuses on exploring men's values and attitudes towards women, mentioned the importance of men and women working together and the need to acknowledge women's participation.
I believe that this celebration not only has to be acknowledged or looked at today, but always. It's a life project. But the issue here is that we can start to bring to the surface all the work, the proposals, the survival, and attitudes of women that are struggling for the benefit of us all. And it is in this effort that we join them.
For Free Speech Radio News, this is Luz Ruiz.
For the first time since 1977, workers at the Marietta, Georgia Lockheed Martin plant are on strike. Dave Lippman has the story.
In the midst of a military aircraft manufacturing boom fed by George Bush's expanded war project, Lockheed is pushing a contract that will hike workers' health benefit costs sharply, threaten their job security, and undermine union strength. The International Association of Machinists voted Sunday night to strike the company, with 84% favoring the strike. They are now picketing around the clock at the plant. Yolanda Harris, an electrician and shop steward, explains the stakes.
We're losing our insurance. They've tripled our insurance. We're losing our benefits. We're losing our job security. A combination of classifications, they're doing away with jobs. And that's our fight. It's a constant threat all the time that they're going to move our jobs. Some of the jobs they have already moved to non-union shops. This group of people is electrical wiring. We've been threatened for 3 years now that they're going to send our work to Mexico.
The machinists represent 2,700 hourly workers at the aircraft manufacturer, which is the largest employer in Cobb County in suburban Atlanta. Picketers express particular concern about the cost of medical benefits for retirees.
The health insurance, they've tripled it. You can't even afford to retire because your health insurance is going to eat up everything that you draw on retirement.
Lockheed Martin management claim they need the leeway to outsource jobs and make cuts in worker benefits in order to maintain the company's competitiveness. David Edwards, a striker who serves on the senior negotiating committee, finds such claims implausible.
They are very competitive. I mean, there are only two kids on the block, us and Boeing, but they want to talk about the economic side, how they want to be competitive. But they're wanting to be competitive by keeping us down. We got people right now that are going out the door, getting laid off now with 23 years seniority out of this plant that have backed their livelihoods and their careers on what was going on at this facility.
Last year, Lockheed received a $200 billion contract to build a new aircraft, the F-35 Joint Task Force Fighter, at their plant in Texas. In Georgia, the company has long-standing orders from the Air Force for F-22 fighter jets and C-130J transport jets, as well as contracts with militaries in other countries. But these good fortunes are hardly translating into a cooperative, United We Stand posture.
We have to hit the streets just trying to protect our contractual language, while at the same time the company's sitting there and saying that we're not patriotic, that we're not part of this community.
For Free Speech Radio News, this is Dave Lippman in Marietta, Georgia.
Free Speech Radio News was produced at Pacifica Station KPFA in Berkeley, California, and Community Radio WMNF in Tampa, Florida. I'm Nell Abram.
I'm Rachel Maher in Melbourne, Australia. Free Speech Radio News is a vital part of global media activism, creating an alternative news network that strengthens and sustains the international movement for social justice. This broadcast only stays on air with your financial support. Please donate to Free Speech Radio News online at www.fsrn.org. That's www.fsrn.org or call 510-287-5551. That's 510-287-5551. Thanks for your support.